Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I know, we started the same way yesterday, too. Blame the lawyers. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, 27th of March. Good to have you with us. Today was day two of the constitutional Woodstock that is the challenge to the health care reform law. On the docket this morning was the individual mandate, the requirement that basically all of us have to have health insurance, up to and including having to buy it if we don't have it already. Our healthcare correspondent Gregory Warner was in the courtroom again today, as he was yesterday. Hey, Gregory.
Hey there, Kai.
All right, another big day for you, pal.
Huge day. And it's as if to underscore this, it was horrible to watch. But 30 seconds into the Solicitor General's argument, I mean, he was stumbling words. He was clearing his throat. He drank some water. He lost his voice.
Like nerves, you think?
I mean, it could have been allergies, but yeah, it sounded like nerves.
All right, once he got going, what did he say?
The theme that kept coming up is what happens to the young, healthy person on the couch, you know, sitting there minding his business.
Yeah, right? You bet. I've been one of those.
Can the government make that person buy insurance? And the liberal justices on the court, they posed questions that suggested absolutely, because, you know, we never know when that person might get hit by a bus. And anyway, they're going to get older and sicker eventually. In Justice Kagan's words, the subsidizers become the subsidized. But conservative justices say, no way. This is an overstep of federal power. And here's Justice Kennedy from this morning's hearing.
And here the government is saying that the federal government has a duty to tell the individual citizen that it must act. And that is different from what we have in previous cases. Well, that changes the relationship of the federal government to the individual in a very fundamental way.
So this is Justice Kennedy, the swing vote, as we've been told so many times, but also raising this question about personal freedom, right?
Exactly. Though swing he did, I will say. Justice Kennedy, more than any justice this morning, was arguing both sides. Because at another point, he said, hey, look, that guy on the couch, he is part of the market for an actuarial reason, because in healthcare, we really are all in this together.
The young person who's uninsured is uniquely, proximately, very close to affecting the rates of insurance and the cost of providing medical care in a way that is not true in other industries. That's my concern in the case.
So take your pick. Kennedy 1, Kennedy 2.
Right.
It could be the fate of the healthcare law.
Uniquely, proximately, very close. I love that. But but let me ask you a different question, maybe sort of blunt. Kennedy's talking about it, you know, we're all in this together. 80% of Americans, the vast majority of people, have health insurance or actually are that guy sitting on the couch who don't need it. So how big a deal is it for them?
I think there are really two answers to that question. One is, look, healthcare is what, 1/6 of our economy? It's on track to be 1/5. So this law has major consequences for not only how the insurance market is based, but also how we control costs. But second, look, I mean, people want to make this about politics, and of course it is in some way, but we've been having this healthcare debate for almost 100 years, since 1914 and Teddy Roosevelt. And, you know, of course, they called him a socialist. So, I mean, so while every other developed country has some kind of healthcare for all system, we don't have one. That's really what the justices are deciding.
Yeah. There was another thing that caught my ear in the arguments today, and I'm sure you heard it as well. It was this issue of whether the government can force Americans to buy something.
And it was really one vegetable that symbolized this. Actually, broccoli was mentioned 8 times on the highest court in the land. And actually, Justice Scalia framed it in what has really become known in legal circles as the broccoli question, which is, as you said, if the government can make everyone enter this health insurance market, why not the food market?
So you define the market as food. Therefore, everybody's in the market. Therefore, you can make people buy broccoli.
So how did broccoli become the symbol of the food that Americans don't want to be made to eat? Well, it might hail back to a pronouncement by George Bush Sr. on the tarmac in 1990.
I do not like broccoli, and I haven't liked it since I was a little kid, and my mother made me eat it, and I'm president of the United States, and I'm not going to eat any more broccoli.
That was the laugh track version that played on all the comedy channels long after. Kermit Roosevelt is a constitutional law professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
if the government actually tried to make you buy broccoli and eat it, I think there would be a constitutional problem with that.
But that's not what the individual mandate does, he says. Making people buy a policy is not the same as telling they have to go to the doctor. And grocers don't write off the cost of giving away billions of dollars of free broccoli and then jack up food prices for the rest of us.
Because we don't have the broccoli emergency rooms where people who first say they don't want broccoli then go and get it and make the taxpayers foot the bill.
But don't mention any broccoli emergencies to this guy.
Yeah, feel a little protective of it.
Thomas Bjorkman is director of the Eastern Broccoli Project at Cornell University. He's devoted the last 20 years, most of his career, to studying this particular vegetable.
I've gotten used to watching it grow. I guess it's like you're used to watching your pet behave in certain ways. I'm used to seeing the broccoli behave in certain ways.
And if he's learned one thing about broccoli, it's this. Most kids love it. It's the best-selling green vegetable. And when Bush said he hated it, broccoli sales shot up the next year. Which makes you realize, Kai, whatever the Supreme Court decides about health care, could be a great year for broccoli.
Wait, broccoli is the most popular green vegetable?
I know, but I like broccoli. You may not.
All right. Anyway, whatever. Gregory Warner at the Supreme Court for us. Gregory, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai.
On Wall Street today, not a great day. It was not terrible, just not great. Kind of, if I might editorialize, just like broccoli. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. To the long, long list of things Democrats and Republicans already disagree on, we can now add today's proposed rule on greenhouse gas emissions from the Environmental Protection Agency. Today, the EPA said it wants to put the first ever federal limits on how much carbon dioxide can come from new power plants. The rules have been a while in coming. The EPA is thinking about it ever since it declared CO2 a dangerous pollutant back in 2009. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports now from the Sustainability Desk.
The new emissions rules don't affect existing coal plants or even coal plants already in the works, but the standards are strict enough that they effectively limit any future fossil fuel plants in this country to either natural gas or so-called clean coal, which is still unproven and costly. Ian Bowles is former Secretary of Energy and Environmental Affairs for Massachusetts.
These rules, as well as some smokestack emissions rules, is going to really curtail the future growth of coal plants.
But Paul Bledsoe, a former Clinton official, says in many ways the new EPA rules are trailing the marketplace.
Low natural gas prices have meant that very few coal plants are being built and very few are expected to be built for the next 10 years in any event. So in a sense, this rule is simply reinforcing current market conditions.
One Clean Air activist today declared that old king coal was teetering toward life support. Well, not quite. Americans still get 45% of their electricity from about 300 coal plants around the country. And big coal is pushing to export more, says analyst Charlie Blanchard at Bloomberg New Energy Finance.
So they would love, the coal companies would love to get that Powder River Basin coal out to China and Asia, where demand is going to continue to grow.
Coal companies are already urging Congress to outlaw the new EPA rules, calling them a poorly disguised cap-and-tax scheme. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The Obama presidential campaign of 2007-2008 was what a baseball aficionado might call small ball. Instead of concentrating on big givers, home run hitters, they targeted small donors, Americans who could afford to give a few bucks or maybe a couple of $100. It obviously paid off, so this time around, Republicans are trying to replicate that grassroots financial strategy, but it's not working for everybody, as Marketplace's David Gura reports from Washington.
Give $750 to Newt Gingrich's campaign, and you can get a Newt 2012 dog bandana. Ron Paul is offering pocket constitutions for $5. Tony Corrado is a political science professor at Colby College.
We see the Santorum campaign doing very well with their promotion of give $100 and get a Rick Santorum sweater vest.
Republicans Newt Gingrich, Rick Santorum, and Ron Paul have been pretty successful with small donors.
Generally, it's the case that those three candidates have raised 40 to 50% of their money from small donations.
Corrado says Mitt Romney, the other GOP candidate, is having trouble.
The hallmark of his campaign fundraising has been his reliance on donors who can give the $2,500 maximum.
Last month, Romney raised about $12 million, and half of his donors maxed out. Bert Johnson teaches political science at Middlebury College.
The people that tend to do best in appealing to small contributors in the Republican race so far have been people who have very crisp, clear, and extreme positions.
Johnson says that's not Romney, but he still needs small donors. Candace Nelson is a government professor at American University.
The advantage of small donors is you can go back to them again and again and again. You know, if you've got a large donor who maxes out, that's it.
So sure, as campaigns and public radio fundraisers say, every dollar makes a difference. But the real value is the email address that comes with a small donation. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
We learned over the weekend that the Pentagon has paid out $50,000 for each of the 17 Afghans killed earlier this month. Staff Sergeant Robert Bales has been charged with the murders. Those kinds of payments are fairly common over there, not so much over here. So we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer for a little bit of background.
Congress has rules for these condolence payments, first established when a U.S. service member killed a German civilian after World War II. That's when Congress passed the Foreign Claims Act, which covers payments for civilian deaths outside of combat. If civilians are killed in combat, U.S. commanders can dip into slush funds set up by Congress during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
It's called blood money.
Sarah Holowinski heads the group Campaign for Innocent Victims in Conflict. She says we're paying more blood money now than ever, partly because it's an ingrained part of Iraqi and Afghan culture.
Blood money is, it's almost a peace negotiation. Okay, now we've settled it. We're fine. We're moving on with our lives.
But the blood money is just a way of saying sorry. Todd Harrison is with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He says the U.S. is not saying that Staff Sergeant Robert Bales is guilty of the shootings.
Because that could jeopardize the trial. The U.S. government is on one hand admitting our person did this, and then on the other hand trying to give the person a fair trial to determine whether or not they did it.
It's not clear how the U.S. military decides what a fair payment is. The norm for civilian death in Iraq or Afghanistan is about $2,500. So the $50,000 settlements in Afghanistan are way above average. Lawrence Korb is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress.
I think it was so high because of the atrocities and the scope of this.
The Pentagon isn't saying how the money was handed out. Sarah Holowinski says the Afghan civilians probably got cash, and not U.S. dollars, but stacks of local currency.
I would suspect it would take a truck to get it over to the families. There must have been a more discreet way that the U.S. military did this.
But the Pentagon won't give details or say what it spent on these payments. Holowinski only knows of one estimate from about 6 years ago when the Inspector General for Iraq reported we were spending about $14 million a year in condolence money. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up...
The technical term for this robot is Godzilla.
Nah, nothing to worry about. Our series, Robots Ate My Job, continues. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped 43 points today, about a third of 1%, wrapped up at 13,197. The NASDAQ ticked down 2 points, nearly a tenth percent, 3120 at the bell. The S&P 500 lost 3 points, a quarter percent, 1412. Is the number you're looking for there. Home prices here in the United States fell for the fifth month in a row. That's according to the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. But home builders still climbed after Lennar announced better-than-expected earnings. Shares in Lennar rose 4.67%. PulteGroup erected a gain of 3%. D.R. Horton nailed down a 2% increase. Pfizer shot up 1.5% today on speculation the drug maker is going to split aggressively. That is, aggressively split the company. Bank of America fell 3.3% after an analyst downgrade. Morgan Stanley cashed out 2%. Citigroup and Wells Fargo took more than 1% off their ledgers. AIG added 2%. The troubled insurer might buy back $20 billion of its stock in the coming year. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell. 2.18% is the yield. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for February. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee discusses U.S. policy on Iran. And she's got a whole lot of wardrobe. Singer Lady Gaga turns 26. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Let's consider, just for a moment, the word like. A simple, everyday verb, to like. I like, you like, they have liked. It has become, thanks to Facebook, the byword of our collective experience in the social media age. So, have you liked anything on Facebook lately? Dean Terry hasn't. He teaches emerging media and communications at the University of Texas, Dallas, where he and some students have come up with a Facebook app they call Enemy Graph. You can think of it, as we did, as the anti-like button. Dean, welcome to the broadcast.
Hi, Kai. Good to be with you.
This is kind of, well, it's kind of blasphemy, right? I mean, it's against the whole social media vibe.
Yeah, Enemy Graph is, in a way, social media blasphemy, but that's because social media is somewhat lopsided in a certain way because of the liking nature of the platforms. When I first saw the first friends list at the beginning of the social media era, the first thing I thought was, well, where's the enemies list? And the app kind of has that attitude because we're suggesting that you share differences you have with people or talk about things you don't like. And it is a sneaky way to do a dislike button on Facebook.
And we should say here, you didn't call it dislike because Facebook doesn't let you call it. They actually say you can't do a dislike button.
That's right. It would last about 3 seconds if we did that.
That's right. The thing is, though, that Facebook's not real life, right? And I'm struck by you trying to impose reality on this thing that is so patently not.
Right, but Facebook is effectively our public space, but it's privatized. Yeah. It has its own philosophy about how people should behave online. And in certain ways, it's almost the whole internet now. And so we're trying to sort of shine a critical light on that. That's the point of the application.
Who have you been disliking? I mean, what was the first thing you did?
Well, every restaurant I go to seems to be playing Journey, so I put Journey on my list.
I can't fault you there.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people are confused by the word enemy. I mean, really, it's a dislike thing. So anything that's a page on Facebook or a group of any kind can be listed.
Do you get a lot of companies being disliked, brands, those kinds of things?
There are a few places where people are disliking brands, yes.
Yeah, for example?
Walmart's on the list, so.
Yeah, that's an easy one. Do you worry about hurt feelings on one end, but all the way to like bullying and, you know, actual cyber malice being done?
We do. I mean, that is an important and sensitive topic, but it's not what our app is about. And I think that a few people who have claimed that, I don't think they've used the app and seen how it's being used. And also, we're seriously misusing the word enemy in the same way that Facebook misuses the word friend. Yeah. And again, it's not really about individuals. Anything can be called an enemy, even food or colors. I just like the color red, for example. and also, it's also opt-in. You have to be friends with someone in order to declare them an enemy. So,
that's making my brain hurt. How does that work?
Right. Well, you have to either be a user of the app or you have to be friends with someone. So the only way I could declare you an enemy is if you're using the app, which I would have no way of knowing, really, or if we're friends.
Right.
So most of the people are calling each other enemies. If it's individuals, it's in jest.
Right. So somebody could go to my Facebook page out there, since I'm you know, who I am in public radio, and enemy me?
Yes, they could.
I don't know how I feel about that.
Well, you can enemy them back, or...
But I'm not that kind of guy.
Or you could unfriend them on Facebook.
All right. Well, maybe I'll do that.
Yeah, maybe you should do that.
Dean Terry, he's the director of the Emerging Media and Communications Program at UT Dallas, University of Texas at Dallas. Dean, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace's David Brancaccio is making a very solo car trip this week, a long, lonely coast-to-coast drive in pursuit of the answer to this question. As technology becomes more and more powerful in our lives and in this economy, who's winning and who's losing? Who's working and who's not? Here's David with another installment of Robots Ate My Job.
It's day 4 after leaving the beach in New Jersey, and I'm outside Oklahoma City now. In 44 more miles, it'll be the halfway point. I'm taking my travel buddy, Wilson the robot dog, for a walk in the parking lot before getting back in the car. Try listening to that for another 1,600 miles. My silver plastic pal, in his own AA battery-powered way, is a very rudimentary virtual companion. And for people who know how to design, build, or operate more cutting-edge robots, it's a golden age of full employment, as I discovered before the trip when I visited one of the top robotics programs in the world. At least one of the receptionists at Carnegie Mellon University is a bit of an odd bird.
Hello. How may I help you?
Marion Lafleur, Tank to his friends, is an animated head shining from a nodding, swiveling computer screen. Got questions? He generally has answers. So, Tank, I'm looking for room 2111.
I'll check. You can take the elevators down to the second floor where the room is located.
Tank is a project of Carnegie Mellon's Robotics Institute down the hall, where its students are working on some wild stuff. Snake robots that can squirm into tight spots for search and rescue. There's Herb, the robot butler, that can learn to navigate around the house to someday help people with disabilities. There are even robot stand-up comedians.
Any of you like television? I find it incredibly educational, actually. As soon as someone turns it on, I go into the other room and read.
Okay, so not side-splitting. But that's not the point. In a world where humans and machines increasingly work together, robots have to learn to pay attention, to read social cues. Our economy may depend on it. And if you don't believe me...
Hello, hello, hello.
How about the President of the United States?
You might not know this, but one of my responsibilities as Commander-in-Chief is to keep an eye on robots. And I'm pleased to report that the robots you manufacture here seem peaceful.
Last June at Carnegie Mellon, President Obama announced a $500 million program to invest in new technologies. It's part of the administration's National Robotics Initiative to improve manufacturing, and the betting is to create jobs, not take them away, as so often is the worry with robots. And the demand for robotic skills is up by more than 40% this past year. Just look at the Where Are They Now alumni page on the Robotic Institute's website. Facebook, Intel, Google talk about the economic winners. But it's important to realize that robotics isn't limited to PhD types working at the technological cutting edge at fancy universities.
The technical term for this robot is Godzilla.
That's David Novak Jr. He's 37 and a skilled maintenance technician at Toyota's motor manufacturing plant in southern Indiana. His job is to keep robots here working.
If, say, this robot doesn't pick up that part, I'm in there trying to figure out why.
He points to a flashing light on the overhanging panel.
That means there's a problem with that robot on that side of the line.
These robots are huge, like a T-Rex, and fast. At Toyota, robots do dangerous and repetitive work, lifting the underbelly of cars and welding the same parts again and again. Note also there are a few thousand human workers at this Toyota plant. And just a few weeks ago, the company announced 400 new jobs here. At Toyota, robot techs make between $42,000 and $69,000 a year, a very good wage for southern Indiana. Novak owns his home and is raising two daughters. He has a two-year associate's degree from nearby Vincennes University, specializing in robotics technology.
Like on this one right here, like program it over here and over there and run it back and forth at 100% speed.
Brett McCandless teaches robotics at Vincennes.
We'll do an assembly application where they incorporate the robot with a vision system to inspect parts.
He says nearly every week a company calls the school trying to hire his students, Toyota, Sony, Rolls-Royce. Vincennes Technology Associates degree program has a 95% job placement rate, and students make about $40,000 starting off. What we're experiencing here is the act of robots creating jobs, but that's not all they do to the workforce. It's late in the day, and McCandless stands in the hallway after class. When you think about how fast technology moves, he says, you start to see every job in a new light. Just then, a janitor pushes a vacuum around a corner.
You see that right there? Okay, that's a potential job to be replaced by a robot.
Right now, humans can use old-fashioned elbow grease to clean all kinds of nooks and crannies that robots can't. But what happens when the day comes when a robot cleaning crew becomes practical? It gives McCandless pause.
What do you care if it runs all day long?
You're not paying it by the hour. It's scary, actually. Where do all these people go that we can replace with machines? I don't have the answer to that.
And when robots do take over our jobs, that's tomorrow. From the road, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
Robots are everywhere. You can watch an interview with one of them on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note as we wrap things up on this Tuesday, an addendum to David Gura's piece earlier about small donors and the political environment. The National Journal has noticed something new about the Newt Gingrich campaign, the struggling and running out of money Gingrich campaign. You go into a rally, you want a picture with the candidate? Credit card number, please. $50 is what it's going to cost you. All right, that's it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow dropped 43 points, a third of 1%, to wrap up at 13,197. The NASDAQ ticked down 2 points, nearly a tenth of 1%, closed at 3120. The S&P 500 off 3 points, a quarter percent, 1412, the number. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.